Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Implications of Recent Data Sets on the Current and Future Use of Non-Targeted Therapy for Metastatic Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. As you know, it's kind of lung cancer week here for us because of the World Lung Cancer Conference that just concluded. So we have a great faculty today to talk about what happened at the meeting and maybe a little bit about what may be happening in the ESMO meeting. Dr. Eddie Garin, from the Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center in Los Angeles at UCLA, and Dr. Luis Pazares from the National Oncology Research Center in Madrid, Spain. Tonight in Barcelona, waiting for the ESMO meeting, I guess, coming up tomorrow. Can't wait to hear about what happens there. Today we're here to talk mainly about immunotherapy, particularly some of the stuff that was presented at the World Lung Meeting, but also what's been going on the last couple years. We're going to try to get into some clinically relevant questions that I've been hearing from oncologists about immunotherapy. As in all of our programs, we will be talking about non-FDA approved uses of agents and regimens. So check out the package insert for more information. Here's where we're heading. We asked both of our faculty to put together brief presentations summarizing key data sets presented at the World Lung Meeting, but also over the last year or so, particularly related to immunotherapy. But we got to start out with, I got to call it Ivo because I have a hard time pronouncing. I guess it's ivonescimib. Pretty hot topic. We even were talking about it the last two nights. We had to, just because it was such a huge story, Eddie. A bispecific that I first heard about it about a year ago, I think. A bispecific where one part hits VEGF, at least to my simple way of looking, and the other part hitting PD-1. Of course, we've seen regimens combining Bev and PD-1. This is a bispecific. So, Eddie, I know you were participated in the trial where they looked at EGFR, and we'll take a look at that data first. But this is a pretty shocking thing. Phase 3 trial done in China, but comparing it to Pembro, first-line metastatic disease, and you can see a higher response rate, a better PFS, hazard rate of 0.51. And here's the part I really like. Hazard rate of 0.46 with PD-1 or TPS greater than 50%, Eddie. So I guess the question is, A, is this for real? Or B, could we get the same thing done by adding Bev? But what are your thoughts? I know this is a very interesting presentation.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, first, I don't think we can know whether we'd get the same thing with adding Bev. We've never tried it. We've never looked at bevacizumab or ramucirumab or any of those antibodies in this setting, in the patients in an upfront setting. Just angiogenesis inhibition in general is not necessarily an answer. That has been looked at. There have been studies looking at like pembrolizumab is part of the LEAP study, along with tyrosine kinase inhibitors that hit angiogenesis targets, and those have not panned out. So although we don't know exactly whether or not you could see the same thing with Bev, this obviously is a provocative data set.
So, in terms of tolerability, it certainly doesn't look like some of the other bispecific, CD3 bispecific, CRS, et cetera, but this is targeting two parts of the same receptor and looks like really just get a little Bev stuff, hypertension and proteinuria. Luis, what's your thought about this? You think this is for real? Or, two, 3 years from now, are we going to be using this instead of Pembro? Or are we going to be adding it to Pembro and chemo?
Of course, I would like to see those data also being validated in some Western population. But to be honest, I really believe on those data. I really believe on the combination of PD-1 inhibition plus antiangiogenics, particularly VEGF inhibition. And as it's been said, maybe the dual inhibition is better than the two drugs, antiangiogenics plus a PD-1 inhibitor. What is true is that the two trials we have seen so far, the data are pretty impressive, at least in terms of PFS and response. And I think so those data should mature. And I'm looking forward also to see some data in Western population. But I really believe on this combination, on this type of drug, really.
Well, we're overdue to try to get a bump from immunotherapy, so I hope this is maybe going to be the beginning of that. Eddie, what about autoimmune toxicity? I mean, it's a different way to block PD-1, but as far as you know, does it cause the same itises, so to speak?
So I think that one of the things that when Dr. Pazarez is talking about replicating in a Western population, I think one of the places where we've been most concerned about that is assessing sort of on toxicity. Do patients and physicians in China only report on toxicity the same way that they would in a Western population? I think it's very hard to know. As you mentioned, we've been part of in the EGFR mutant population. The data that's been presented to date is China only, but there are now studies where they have looked at expanding this into Western populations. That's the study that we have been part of. So eventually, we will see that data in a Western population. But that is the tolerability they have seen to date is quite good. But I think there is some concern among us that the tolerability in general in China-only studies has been a little bit better than we might anticipate in Western populations. And what exactly contributes to that is a little hard to know.
And Luis Rosanna in the chat room wants to know, do you think this agent could get approved just based on this phase 3 trial, or is FDA going to want to see data from North America? And also, I'm curious, Luis, what you think about this trial. We were talking about this the last two nights. You know, again, IOs aren't usually part of treatment of EGFR mutant disease, but when they combine this with chemotherapy, a phase 3 study, it looked like it benefited. So, A, Luis, you think this is going to get approved with the data we have now? And B, what do you think about, is this going to be an exception to the IO rule, or is this all about VEGF?
Well, I think most likely the agencies, U.S. and Europe, are going to ask some type of data, particularly safety, but also some efficacy data in Western population. I'm not meaning necessarily a phase 3, maybe a robust phase 2. I don't know. You know, we have seen that happening in some with some of the other agents. In relation to the concept of a dual inhibitor of PD-1 and a VEGF, I mean, the idea is really attractive. Take into account you're not only inhibiting here VEGFR 1, 2, and 3, because you're inhibiting all of them, because you're actually targeting the ligand. The second important thing is you're doing both at once, so you're really decreasing, in theory, the infiltration by myeloid cells into the tumor. You're facilitating the inflammation by T cells into the tumor. So altogether, with PD-1 inhibition, makes sense that you're getting better results. But of course, this has to be proven. Yeah.
And again, toxicity at this point going to be a little bit hard to sort out. So really an exciting thing to think about for the future. Just kind of curious, Eddie, right now, this is one of the questions we got from oncologists in terms of when you end up using the Empower approach with atezo-bev right now in your practice.
So in patients that do not have EGFR mutations, I have not really used the Empower regimen. I think that is one place where we have seen, in this case, with chemotherapy, but have seen evidence that incorporates an anti-angiogenic. The one place in my practice I have used it is among patients with EGFR mutations. And that has been a place where it's been very difficult to incorporate immunotherapy. I think that I would argue the data is a little mixed on whether or not this is an approach that is appealing in EGFR mutation positive patients. Also, I will say, oftentimes it is very difficult when discussing with a patient who often has been on a single well-tolerated pill for oftentimes a couple of years, sometimes even more, to then have them go to a four-drug regimen where they're going to lose their hair, where they're going to have the toxicities associated with all of these regimens. So I think it is a selective group of patients, but I certainly have used it in some patients, particularly younger, healthy patients. And we have seen some patients do quite well, better than we might have anticipated. And occasionally, although we are as a community generally skeptical of the role of immunotherapy among patients with EGFR mutations, there is an occasional patient who appears to do reasonably well with the approach.
So before we start jumping into a lot of data, we're going to look at a case from Dr. Garin in a second. But before we get into the case and the whole issue of first-line therapy, Luis, I've got a bunch of questions that I've been, to bring up when we get a chance. One of the more common questions we get is, how do you manage people who have a first-line therapy of metastatic disease, no targetable mutations, who had prior Pacific regimen, who had prior durvalumab, and how do you take into account how long it's been since they completed their durvalumab before you decide what you're going to do first-line in terms of IO, Luis?
Okay, I'd like to remember here that we have very little data, very little evidence. What we do is common sense. So if we have, let's say, reasonable time since durvalumab on the Pacific regimen, I tend to do chemo plus IO, adding IO to my first-line therapy regime. If the period without immunotherapy is very low, imagine less than 4 months, maybe I'm doubting this is going to work. But I would say if I have to give a number, 6 months would be for me maybe a reasonable number to say less than 6 months or more than 6 months, I will add it to my chemotherapy in the first line.
So maybe someday we'll be using Ivo in that situation. Who knows? But I want to get to Eddie's case. And everybody knows I love cases that start 92-year-old. He actually has a 96-year-old. I just found out that's similar to this. I want to hear about that as well. But tell me about this 92-year-old lady who you tell me was in pretty good condition before she ended up getting COVID and then being diagnosed with lung cancer.
Yeah, she had an extensive smoking history. It quit a while ago, although in further discussion, I think occasionally smokes at least a little bit on still. Otherwise, good health, distant history of breast cancer, but has been doing well from that for a while. Actually, it's a little more complicated because the original concern was that she would have locally advanced disease, which is not so easy to manage in a 92-year-old. The idea of doing concurrent chemoradiotherapy is probably not a real possibility, but didn't end up undergoing a bronchoscopy. And the thing that was sort of a little bit cutesy about it is that although they only sent one of the specimens for NGS, they sent both a biopsy of the primary mass, which could be reached by bronchoscopy, as well as the lymph node for PD-L1. And one came back at 30% and one came back at 60%. Then in terms of the staging, it became a little bit easier when there were two very tiny brain metastases, but large enough to be noted to be real in the patient's case that we would be treating for systemic disease only.
I want to ask Luis how he thinks through first-line therapy in general, not just in a patient with a high PD-1, but a patient with PD-1 of zero. Just in general, I want to talk about first-line therapy. But I want to know what you think about this case, Luis, and how you think you might have managed this. Would you give her SRS to the brain? I guess she was asymptomatic from that. And, of course, what kind of systemic approach? Also, Luis, how often do you see a disparity in the PD-1 level here? It's really interesting, 30 versus 60.
Okay, I think if you were doing assessment of PD-L1 in two sides of the tumor, you will see very often some disparity. Typically, we just assess one single place, the primary or the metastasis. We do not typically do many places, but we know that at least in 25% of the cases, there are some disparity. Concerning to the treatment of non-small cell lung cancer first line, I tend to use immunotherapy unless there is a contraindication. If the patient is PD-L1 high, very often I use a PD-L1 inhibitor alone. If it's lower than 50%, I tend to use it with chemo. For that particular case, I think it's an excellent idea, considering the age of the patient and so on, to try a PD-1 inhibitor on its own. Concerning the question of giving radiotherapy to the brain, stereotactic radiation or not, I mean, if my patient is asymptomatic, the metastases are really small, not on a very, let's say, critical place into the brain, and I would tend to go with immunotherapy alone. There are some phase two data validating that concept. I have to say that most of the trials, when they treat brain patient with brain metastasis, they ask you to have the patient irradiated before entering the study. However, we already got some data, including a Spanish trial, I remember right now, that you can do it if the patient is asymptomatic from the brain metastasis point of view. So for this very case, I would use a PD-1 inhibitor on its own, pembrolizumab, for example, and if she's asymptomatic, I will go on having an early brain MRI to be sure that she responded.
So they say great minds think alike, and it sounds like you accurately predicted how this patient was going to get treated, but I'm curious about what happened to the patient, and also, Eddie, what you would have done with this lady if, let's say, both of those PD-1 levels were like about 10, and what you would have done if they were zero with her, with this lady.
Sure. So so in the end, I co-managed this with a local, someone locally. I recommended single agent PD-1 inhibition. They ended up getting cemiplimab, and they've done very well. They're nearly 2 years out from this. Now, the question of what I would do if they had a PD-L1 of 10%, I still may have been inclined to start with single agent PD-1 inhibition. I think that when one looks at the data from the KEYNOTE-042 study, it didn't appear in that group of patients that it was better to give pembrolizumab than chemotherapy, but it wasn't worse either. And a 92-year-old, sometimes I certainly worry that with a platinum-based chemotherapy, I'll quickly make her look 92, even if she doesn't look 92 beforehand. So I think it becomes a more difficult issue when the PD-L1 is zero, because we don't have an approval for pembrolizumab in that setting. I have in many cases gone to single agent pemetrexed in that case. I think that is a reasonable option, and that's something that I have done in patients who are doing okay, but I don't think they'll be able to tolerate platinum-based chemotherapy.
So you got to tell them what happened with the brain mets.
They did well also. Yeah.
You didn't radiate though, right? So nope. Systemic therapy. And they went away. Mm-hmm. And what made you choose cemiplimab?
Again, I was co-managing with something and with someone else. And there are, you know, I think the data between the two drugs is very similar. And I think there were some reimbursement issues in that particular case.
Interesting. Any thoughts, Luis, in terms of, again, older patient, where you're really hesitant about chemotherapy, 92-year-old, et cetera? How would you think it through, again, PD-1 zero?
So I think it's very important to evaluate in that particular case if the patient is candidate to platinum-based chemo or not. If the patient would have been candidate, I could try maybe, let's say, an easy regime of carbo-pem plus pembro with maybe reduced dose to start with. But still, if the patient is not candidate, there are a randomized trial, the Ipsos trial, showing that PD-1 agent, a PD-L1 inhibitor, is better than single agent chemotherapy in this very setting, regardless the PD-L1 expression. So if I'm thinking this patient is not candidate for chemo, for a doublet, I would go to a PD-1 agent in any case.
Interesting. All right, Eddie, you prepared some slides looking at some of the data that's been presented recently and others that really relate in general to what we've just been talking about. So go for it.
Sure. So at this point, people are very familiar with the single agent data for with pembrolizumab showing, really a very good long-term survival. This is the analogous data from the Empower Lung 1. This is looking at cemiplimab and is very confirmatory with really you can see the probability of survival here with about 30% of the people that are alive 5 years out, which I think is encouraging. This is, again, for patients who have high PD-L1 expression. PD-L1 expression in 50% of the tumor cells or greater. Empower Lung 3 is sort of the analog to the studies like Keynote 189, Keynote 407, looking at chemotherapy plus cemiplimab. Here, again, the data is not as mature. You can see that at 2 years, still 40% of the patients were surviving compared to 27% in the in the chemotherapy arm. We do have more mature data, of course, on the pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy outcomes. This was presented at ASCO by Marina Garasino, and what you can see here is the sort of overall survival. As well as the progression-free survival in this group. The overall survival here, when you start looking out, is certainly impressive compared to when I would have started my practice or when we were giving chemotherapy alone. The one thing that I would say that has been a disappointment about the long-term data with these agents is it's not entirely clear to me that it's substantially better than the immunotherapy. So clearly the curves probably are better, but the question is whether the chemotherapy is increasing the rate of long-term responders. I think that's a little harder to necessarily convince myself. So in terms of dual immunotherapy, this is, although this is a study that people have seen a lot, I still think it's a little bit more complex of a study. This is, I sometimes describe it as a six-arm, four-bin study. Patients were stratified based on PD-L1 of greater than 1% or less than 1%. Both groups had one arm that was nivolumab plus ipilimumab. One arm was chemotherapy, and that was in both groups. But in the patients with PD-L1 expression of greater than 1%, nivolumab was the third arm, where it was nivolumab and chemotherapy in those with PD-L1 expression of less than 1%. And what you can see here you can see the data in the greater than 1%, and you can see the favorable long-term, now we have six-year data with nivolumab plus ipilimumab, showing, that many of these patients are remaining alive, over 20% are alive more than 6 years out. And in the less than 1%, which is a group that we would have typically thought of patients doing less well, over 15% of the patients are doing well, which is really sort of what we've seen with PD-1 inhibitors in general when they have, when you see long-term outcome data. So this data is certainly interesting to see this group of patients doing well long-term. Interestingly, the FDA approval for this regimen is only in patients who are PD-L1 greater than 1%, because that's what the primary analysis group of the study was. Also, I think when one looks at this study, you have to take into context that it is going to be a more robust group of patients that you're going to be willing to look at both chemotherapy, both nivolumab and ipilimumab. The CTLA-4 inhibitor does add some additional toxicity. And here you can see another long-term outcome data, 5 years in this case, from CheckMate 9LA, which is two cycles of chemotherapy along with nivolumab and ipilimumab. Again, you can see a very impressive long-term survival, here, particularly in those with PD-L1 expression of less than 1%, over 20% of the patients. Although, again, I think it has to be interpreted in the context of being a group of patients robust enough to get this combination. And last from this sort of suite of studies looking at PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors and CTLA-4 inhibitors, the Poseidon study is a three-arm study looking at durvalumab alone along with chemotherapy, durvalumab, tremelimumab and chemotherapy, or chemotherapy alone. The top arm here of durvalumab and chemotherapy did not end up hitting its endpoint, but the triplet of durvalumab, I guess it ends up being quadruplet because it's two different chemotherapies, durvalumab, tremelimumab, and platinum-based chemotherapy was superior to platinum-based chemotherapy. Here you can see the five-year overall survival, again, over 15% of the patients alive more than 5 years out.
So a lot of questions. Just the first, just to pick up on what you were just saying, can you comment a little bit more? I'll ask Luis about the Durva-Tremi chemo trial, and are there situations where you think you'd want to use that strategy? And any thoughts in terms of comparing it toxicity-wise to Ipi-Nivo chemo?
Okay. So the first thing is that, considering that the combination of PD-1 and CTLA-4 inhibitors, such as Ipi-Nivo, had given some satisfactory results with or without chemo, and then having this concept validated in the Poseidon trial with a different PD-L1 inhibitor and a different CTLA-4, I mean, somehow provides me more faith on that particular concept. The typical patient where I tend to use it is particularly on PD-L1 negative patients. And the other population I'm really happy to are in those with some of the immunosuppressant type of mutations. Let's say LKB1, KIP1. I think very consistently the data on sub-analysis from the CheckMate 227, the 9LA, and even the Poseidon, they are very consistent in terms of showing this patient population being the one that maybe deserve more benefit.
So, Eddie, again, any thoughts in terms of comparisons of toxicity, Durva-Tremi, plus or minus chemo versus Ipi-Nivo? And in what situations are you thinking about CTLA-4?
Yeah, I think that in terms of the differences between them, they're obviously the toxicity tends to be pretty similar. I think the main thing that is different is what the treatment is. So the 9LA regimen gives less chemo, so you only get two cycles of the chemotherapy. But it continues with the CTLA-4 inhibitor, whereas there's sort of a more limited period of time with the CTLA-4 inhibitor in the Poseidon regimen, but it is more chemotherapy. And so I think that the tolerability seems to be similar between them, but there is that difference.
That's interesting. So I guess we're getting some questions related to your 92-year-old lady. First, I had a question of whether or not you've discussed potentially stopping therapy with her. She's now 2 years. And one question we get from oncologists a lot is, what about cell-free DNA in making the decision about whether to stop IO, Eddie?
So maybe I'll start with the first question, which is the cell-free DNA. I think that in general, it's likely that the cell-free DNA is going to be low in patients who are well controlled on therapy. I don't think of it as a validated method for determining when to stop therapy. It is something that's interesting in Europe. I'm sure that it's more mandated that people stop at 2 years. In the U.S., we really don't have that. We were part of a study of nivolumab. There was a randomized discontinuation study. After a year of therapy, people were randomized to either keep going or stopping. And interestingly, although the study design's a little murky, in the intent-to-treat population, the patients who kept going clearly did better. Now, what the implications for that at 2 years are, we don't entirely know. But I think it's certainly in someone of this age, it's very reasonable to stop. I will tell you that it's a bit of a more complicated case, but my 96-year-old that I mentioned and that you mentioned earlier, that patient is beyond 2 years and insists on continuing to come in for her immunotherapy. So I think that at least in the U.S., oftentimes we can make it a personalized decision. And in that case, I've talked to her about potentially stopping. She is 96, and as you can imagine, over time, her care may be more dictated by non-cancer issues. But from the patient's perspective, she's been very insistent.
Maybe you'll get to set the Olympic record for, checkpoint inhibitors at 102 or something. But Luis, one final thing. I always brag about our chat room because they always come up with stuff I never heard about. So first of all, getting back to this age in the people in their 90s. So GN says, any data for single agent chemo plus IO such as carbo or NAB? And here's the one I really like from Dilip. He's always coming up with something cool. Have you ever heard of the Elvis trial, Luis? I just looked it up. Believe it or not, it's a phase 3 trial of single agent vinorelbine, 2001, as first line treatment of elderly patients. Have you heard of that one? I have not. I like the name, though.
Yeah. I think this is, if I'm not wrong, is an Italian trial.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Yeah.
Elderly lung cancer, vinorelbine, Italian study.
Yeah. So because of those trials, they set up single-agent chemotherapy as a standard of care for elderly patients. Thank goodness there was another trial a bit later showing that doublets of chemotherapy with carboplatin, not cisplatin, but carboplatin doublets were better as compared to single agent chemotherapy. That is the reason that today, if we have a patient that we feel is eligible for chemotherapy, we tend to do doublets with or without, in that case, a PD-L1 inhibitor. Unless the patient is not candidate, in that case, single agent PD-L1 inhibitor is maybe the way to go.
All right, well, let's get back to your slides. I'm sorry, go ahead, Eddie.
Oh, the only thing that I was going to say is this, sometimes this gets a little bit complicated, though, because we have some of these studies and they'll be conducted in the elderly, and oftentimes they'll use the cutoff for age for elderly at 70 years old. And so the question becomes, how much can you extrapolate a study of the elderly to someone who's 92? And I think it depends on the patient in front of you and your decision. But there are times when it's made me concerned that just because people over 70 appear to do better with something, whether that means that the 92-year-old I'm seeing will.
Yeah, that is the reason.
Italians. Go ahead, Luis.
No. I think that is the reason clinical judgment is still important for physicians.
That's for sure. I was just going to say, in myeloma, the Italians had this idea of very elderly, but they call that 75. I call 75 young. But anyhow, we need more studies, 85 to 95. Let's get back to your slides, Eddie. Something we hear a lot of questions about, Dato.
Yeah, since we're focusing on immunotherapy, we're going to be talking about the incorporation of antibody drug conjugates along with immunotherapy. Here you can see from the TROPION Lung 2, here you can see datopotamab deruxtecan plus pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy as first line therapy. You can see that it's a somewhat complicated study. They tested two different dose levels of datopotamab deruxtecan, 4 and 6 milligrams per kilogram. And in the doublet, they combined with pembrolizumab. In the triplet, they combined with pembrolizumab and either carboplatin or cisplatin. And, so this is a very complicated slide. I might, rather than look at everything, just focus on the top line, which is the objective response rate, as well as the bottom line, which shows the duration of response. Maybe focusing on the bottom line first, the duration of response was quite good, and that I think is certainly encouraging. The response rate that you see here, I think it's hard. These are fairly small numbers. In some of these cases, the triplet doesn't really perform better than the doublet, the triplet including chemotherapy, whereas the doublet does not. And it's also hard to know how these things compare to what one would see if you were to give immunotherapy in this population. You can see it broken down by PD-L1 less than 1%, 1 to 49, and greater than 50. And I think that clearly what we see in the in the less than one is more than we would expect to see. But sometimes it's hard when you get numbers like what you see with the triplet in the patients who are greater than 50%, how much this is better than what we might expect. And the other thing that complicates this, of course, is that there really is the ability to give chemotherapy along with a PD-1 inhibitor outside of an antibody drug conjugate. And some practitioners do that. Here you can see the waterfall plot from these agents. And you can see that most patients do derive benefit and that in some of these cases, the degree of benefit is quite significant. And we are just coming off of the World Lung Conference in San Diego. This was the first presentation. Janelle Gray presented the data. And what this was a study that was looking to incorporate an antibody-drug conjugate along with chemotherapy and an immune checkpoint inhibitor. And you can see the results here for non-squamous, which is cohort C, and then squamous, which was cohort D. In both cases, it was with carbo and sacituzumab govotecan. The histology-specific chemotherapy wasn't an issue here because, of course, the pemetrexed or paclitaxel was replaced with sacituzumab govotecan. Here you can see the response rate on top is circled, and you can see that clearly there was an impressive response rate. However, again, it is a little difficult to know how this would compare, for instance, to the available standard chemotherapies along with an immune checkpoint inhibitor. Here you can see what's often called a tornado plot, looking at the differences in toxicity. But this is a little bit of an unusual tornado plot, I would argue. Usually what you're looking at in a tornado plot is you're comparing two different therapies one to each other. And in this case, they, in the safety run-in, evaluated sacituzumab govotecan at 10 milligrams per kilogram. And basically determined that it was better to go forward with 7.5 milligrams per kilogram of sacituzumab govotecan. And so that this tornado plot is simply showing that the reason for not moving forward with the 10 milligram per kilogram, which was considerably less well tolerated than the 7.5 milligram per kilogram. Now, TIGIT is a checkpoint inhibitor we've been hearing about for a long time. There has been a tremendous amount of clinical development about it, although I might argue we've seen not a lot of clinical data on it, despite a tremendous amount of clinical development. Here you can see sort of the study that launched the enthusiasm. This was the Cityscape study where tiragolumab, which is an inhibitor of TIGIT, was combined with atezolizumab versus placebo and atezolizumab. And you can see that the response rate was nearly twice when the tiragolumab was combined with atezolizumab. And here you can see the progression-free survival, which was strongly in favor of the tiragolumab combination. Now, this was in patients who were high PD-L1, and this was actually not exactly what we might have expected from atezolizumab alone. It was a bit surprising, and we don't have the data on the follow-up phase 3 study. There has been some data that has been part of a data leak, so we have had access to it as a community that shows still trends in favor of the tiragolumab in a pivotal phase 3 study, but nothing achieving statistical significance at this point, and we're awaiting the final data and eventually a scientific presentation of that data. Here you see another study, though, that is looking at another TIGIT-directed therapy. In this case, you can see that, and I think for ease, even the company has started to refer to these as Zim and Dom. Zim is a PD-1 antibody, Dom being a TIGIT antibody. There's actually a three-arm study that also looked at an A2R antagonist. I'm just going to focus on the anti-TIGIT arm anyway. But you can see here that the response rate was increased when the anti-TIGIT agent was added to the anti-PD-1 agent. And in addition, you can see here the progression-free survival, which again, both the green and the blue here did include both Zim and Dom. The green did include this A2R antagonist, but that both of them, at least in this study, did appear to look better for progression-free survival than the PD-1 inhibitor alone. Here you can see the toxicity data, and there were, as one would imagine, in a patient population like this, many treatment emergent events. In terms of related to treatment, many of them may not have been. And in terms of grade 5 related to treatment, the rate was very low, in the 2-4% range.
Anyhow, it's really great to hear a little bit different in terms of immunotherapy. We'll see where that heads. But I just want to come back to Luis for a second and ask for your thoughts. We see so many trials now, trying to emulate, I think, what's been done in bladder cancer with IO plus ADC. A lot of breast cancer trials, looking at that strategy, and a lot of lung cancer trials. I'm kind of curious, Luis, what your thoughts are about those studies, for example, compared to, just adding chemo to an IO. Do you think there's something special about an ADC?
Well, I have to say that the data so far in phase 2 trial of combining ADC plus PD-1 inhibitor are fine. They are not truly overwhelming. So this is not the case of seeing synergy of such as, for example, we have seen with enfortumab vedotin in bladder cancer. So we have to see how those phase 3 trial ongoing are actually finishing. But my expectation would be if there is some benefit, maybe, but it's not going to be overwhelming as we have seen before in bladder cancer. Indeed, we still don't know what is the reason for such a synergy, to be honest.
So I want to move on now and let Luis go through some other data, particularly on new approaches to treatment. But first, I want to see what Eddie thinks about this case that Luis has of a 68-year-old man. What happened with him?
Okay, so he was a smoker with mild COPD, diagnosed in January 2021 of resectable lung cancer. And after lobectomy and mediastinal lymphadenectomy, was a PT2N0, so the patient didn't receive further treatment and was on follow-up. A bit later, in May 2021, relapse in the liver, and the patient was treated with the typical first-line chemo-IO regime, platinum, pimetrecet, plus nivo, and a fourth, another experimental immunotherapy. So that was a quadruplet. The patient was okay for a year, but a year later, June 22, relapse. And now relapse in the brain and in the liver. So that means it's a patient in good health that had progressed to first-line chemotherapy in the liver and in the brain. And what would be the treatment for that very patient?
Eddie, any thoughts?
Yeah, so the standard approach in someone who's already gotten chemoimmunotherapy would be docetaxel. I think in the U.S., in many cases, we might add ramucirumab. In Europe, they also have the ability to add nintedanib. But that would be our standard treatment approach. But I think it's one we find in general unsatisfying and tends to be probably the most common patients we enroll on clinical trials because of that.
Anything being compared to docetaxel that's got you excited, Eddie? Any thoughts about whether data is going to fit in here in the future? We'll look at the data in a second, but just kind of curious where you think it's heading.
Well, in our own practice, Aaron Lisberg at my institution presented the the datopotamab deruxtecan data at ESMO last year. And in my experience, in general, it is better tolerated than docetaxel at the standard dosing. What I would say, though, is that when one looks at the numbers in the presentation, you might have trouble convincing people of that. The numbers look reasonably similar. So I will tell you anecdotally that I think it's better tolerated, but the numbers don't clearly bear that out.
All right, well, we'll talk a little bit more about that after we look at the data, but let's just follow up with this case, kind of an interesting follow-up here, Luis.
So this patient was actually offered a clinical trial that randomized patients to sasigovitecan, another ADC, also with a topo 1 payload versus docetaxel. Patient was actually randomized to sasigovitecan, and as you see here, had a clear early response, you see. But I just show here the liver mets that clearly decreased. And actually, the patient was doing fine for a while, but after some time, now it's actually 32 cycles. This is a bit more than 2 years. The patient is still okay. I have to say, as I mentioned, that had some toxicity. We have to dose reviews for a couple of times because of delays due to myelosuppression. The patient never had a severe infection, but really we were having issues of dose delay. And in addition, he has some diarrhea, nausea in some occasions. So tolerance was pretty okay, but some dose reduction were required.
We know from breast cancer they're often using preemptive growth factors. Was that part of that trial? Did the patient have growth factors?
Yes, you could use it as expected, and we really use in every single course after the initial myelosuppression the patient was given G-CSF.
All right, let's talk about some of the data.
Okay, wonderful. So thank you very much. So I really, and I think it's pertinent here to thank, first of all, in terms of the ADCs, to the datopotamab, as all of you know, is a top two directed antibody that's been shown some efficacy in early phase 1 and phase 2 data, particularly in patients with actionable genomic aberrations. In the TROPION-Lung01 trial, patients were randomized in this phase 3 study to receive datopotamab versus docetaxel. And as you see here, there was a clear improvement in PFS in favor of the experimental datopotamab. However, the benefit was actually confined for those patients with non-squamous histology on the left. As you see here on the right, squamous patients didn't benefit at all, even they maybe had worse outcome on dato as compared to, Taxotere, the standard of care. Importantly, at the EAS meeting at the World Lung Cancer Meeting 2024, there was an update on survival with some mature data. As you see here, the data overall for survival didn't meet the survival endpoint with a hazard ratio which was 0.84 in favor of datopotamab, but across the unity, so it was not statistically significant. When you analyze the data by histology, you realize, of course, squamous, they don't have benefit at all, and non-squamous, they tend to have a better data, numerically benefit, but the statistical significance is not quite yet there. So those are the data as today. Importantly, there was another presentation by Dr. Garasino that looked at the expression of TROP2 by a more, let's say, computational pathology methodology. So what they talk normalized membrane ratio. And those patients with higher expression, they did benefit, as you see here, but those patients with lower expression didn't benefit. And that was only true when treated with datuderustican. So that means this is not a prognostic factor, but it's a predictive factor when treated with datuderustican. The question here, are we going to be able to reproduce those data? How easy is to use those computational pathology methods, and how easy are to reproduce? Because indeed, as a predictive marker, looks pretty good.
So I'm curious, Eddie, what you think about this new TROP assay. I mean, this comes up in other tumors, breast cancer, et cetera. We can't seem to find a correlation with TROP2 levels and the anti-TROP2 ADCs. What do you think about this new approach, Eddie?
So in this case, I must admit I'm decidedly undecided. and the reason that I say that is, this is one of those difficult situations where they have 7 minutes to make a presentation on a highly computational analysis. And one of the things that you have to remember about a biomarker is, if you give me all of the data, I could figure out times of the day for the first infusion that correlate with outcome. But we don't think that what time you give that infusion is going to be the main important thing in terms of driving the treatment. Whenever you have a biomarker, you need to validate it in a new set of data that where you didn't train the data. And so I think that the biomarker is intriguing, but I would say on the data that we have seen to date, it's not enough to let me know that this is going to sort of crack the case for us in terms of finding the biomarker for datopotamab deruxtecan or any other TROP2 agent.
So one other question about data back to you, Eddie, relates to the mucositis that's been seen. I'm curious what your experience is with that. Your former breast cancer colleague, Sarah Hurvitz, who got stolen by Tom Lynch and his group, and then you replaced them with Aditya Bardia. Every Bardia from MJ is like the NFL with you guys switching around people. But anyhow, Sarah would say, data in breast cancer, the mucositis is prevented with the steroid mouthwash. What do you find with lung, Eddie?
We have found the steroid mouthwash to help. Some of the patients feel that like chewing on ice chips during the infusions have helped. I think that as time goes on, if this agent becomes incorporated into our standard approaches, I assume we will get better at treating this toxicity. But where it stands, it is bothersome to patients and does contribute to what I would say, again, is, data of toxicity that doesn't look as much better as I have felt it is in my own hands compared to standard docetaxel.
All right, sacituzumab govitecan. We talk about that all the time in breast cancer, very commonly used ADC, very effective. What do we know about it in non-small cell lung cancer, Luis?
So early data were somehow promising. Phase 3 trial also, the EVOKE 01 was performed, SASI versus docetaxel in pretreated patients with chemo plus IO in patients without genomic aberrations. As you see here, the main result was that there was a numerical benefit, not quite reaching a statistical significance in favor of SASI govitecan. In the sub-analysis, there were a couple of subgroup of patients where the result looked better. One was clearly for those with genomic aberrations, and the other was the patients that didn't respond to first-line therapy. Indeed, looking more in detail to those patients, hazard ratio for those patients that didn't respond was 0.75. That translated into an increase of more than 3 months in median OS. However, for those patients that did respond, PR or CR, they didn't benefit at all. The benefit in non-responders to first line was similar in squamous and non-squamous histology, as you see here. And importantly, in this World Lung Cancer meeting, there was a split, a sub-analysis for those patients that had a stable disease as a bad response in first line as compared to those that had progression as a primary response. And as you see here, in both cases, they seem to benefit in that sub-analysis for sacituzumab. So altogether, they seem that those patients that are not responding are benefiting. There was another sub-analysis depending on if the patient had less or more than 6 months of benefit from the initial immunotherapy. And as you see here, the benefit was clear for those patients with primary resistance, but also for those with secondary resistance, as you see in this analysis. There was another drug which is already in development by MSD and a partner, SACI, Tuzumab Tirumotecan, which is another TROP2 inhibitor with early data, particularly intriguing for those patients with EGFR mutation. Look at those patients already pre-treated, responses in the range of 60% as compared to only 26% in patients with wild-type disease. So I think those data are interesting and actually confirm the data of Datuderustecan, Sacituzumab, and also with this agent, that the best activity is always seen in patients with actionable genomic aberrations.
So I want to know what Duo Body PDL141BB is.
Okay, so this is an agent that is, let's say, binds to PDL1, but also targets the co-stimulating effector receptor 4-1BB, also called CD137. And it is interesting, this agent is being modified as compared to the initial agents targeting 4-1BB. It looks like somehow liver tox is somehow reduced, even there are some. In this initial study, after the dose was established, there were like three arms, single agent in combination with pembrolizumab at two regimes, with the duo body given every 3 weeks or every 6 weeks. As you see here, particularly looking at the confirmed response, but also at the PFS, those patients treated with a combination of acasulimab plus pembrolizumab, particularly with the every 6 weeks dosing of acasulimab, they were doing the best, responses in about 20% of the cases, but longer PFS. The number of patients are not great. The reason behind that, looking at the biological studies in parallel, is that maybe you should, let's say, co-stimulate for 4-1BB somehow, but not too much. If you're doing too much, you're favoring the lymphocyte exhaustion, and therefore you're losing forces. And that is what is happening behind. Toxicity-wise, I have to say that there were some liver tox, and as you see here, for those patients treated with the every 6 week regime, toxicity was somehow lower. Still, more than 20% of the patients receive it, but grade 3 tox was lower when using this every 6 weeks regime.
So, wow, super cool. Eddie, any thoughts about this? And what's the difference? You know what the difference between this and a bispecific is? Like a duo body, it sounds kind of similar.
Yeah, and so this sort of reminds me, when I was an undergrad at MIT, most of my buddies were engineers, and they used to make fun of me because they would say, you know, our processing speed, increases, it doubles every 18 months, and you guys in medicine are making sort of marginal advances over long periods of time. And what I always said is it's easier to manipulate something that you've made than something that you haven't. And so I think that once you get into these engineering approaches, you know, it can be really exciting because we're designing it. So the Duo body is a little bit different in that what it's designed is that the PD-L1 is supposed to basically bring the T cells into the physical space where the tumor is, and there stimulate 4-1BB to stimulate the T cell activity. So it's actually a drug that's engineered in many respects to stimulate an immune response at the site of the tumor. And so that's, I think, the thing that makes it a particularly unique approach.
So, wow, so interesting. And thanks so much to both of you, Eddie and Luis, for working with us today. Audience, thank you so much for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great evening. Thanks so much, Eddie. Thanks so much, Luis. Have a good one.
Thank you.